Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And as we appeal to heaven, let's consider either joining forces, or at least if you want to have a public appeal, let me know. We'll put it up on the webpage as we did, or in like manner as Loudoun Liberty is up there. And your campaign should have began already. You're behind the eight ball already. So we've got Tammy back, and we were just talking, going through the we're going through the Articles of Confederation, and I was yapping my gums about Massachusetts, and I was trying to point out why Massachusetts felt the way they did, because they were above the other states, and they were. They had a higher per capita that was educated. They were the most educated state in the Union. They were also the healthiest state in the Union, because the average life expectancy of adults was about 70 years of age. Now, you may be muted if you're going, wow, that's actually pretty good for that time. So
yeah, that actually is.
Okay. And they still were inflicted with the common infant mortality rate. But for the most part, they had really progressed very well, because, I mean, there was a stark difference in mortality rates compared to everywhere else. Now,
why do you think that is?
Well, I think education had a lot to do with it, the being more health-oriented in that education. I mean, they were about enlightenment and trying to, you know, bring everybody's productivity up. Now, they were very intolerant regarding, you know, these other paradigms, you know. Well, and what I mean by that is they were intolerant towards anybody that tried to preach anything outside what they had, you know, decided. You must conform to this doctrine. So when people decided to bring up a spin on that, and I forget the people's names, but one of them was cast into New Hampshire and created the state of New Hampshire. This is way back in the 1600s. And another one was cast out, you know, to the, I think it was the south, southeast, which was Connecticut. So two states in the New England states, two states were created from the Puritans. And it was due to religious intolerance. Now, I need to say this because there are a lot of people that have forged their way into this is what we have to do. And some of those are pretty big organizations. You hear me, you know, pick on the John Birch Society, and today won't be any different. But there are lots of other small and, you know, other quasi-big, decent size, like the Anna von Ritz movement, and or these other movements that get people involved. The reason why the states were being divided and conquered was because they weren't united on the fundamental principles of holding England accountable. They were all kind of fending for themselves. And the tyranny began in like the 1760s. And we've covered this in the Tory Acts, because I believe they went back to 1762 or 1763 regarding the petitions, because they knew that's really when England started laying a heavy hand on them. And so they put up with this for about 10 some odd years, a little over a decade, right? Almost a decade and a half. But they finally got it, and they said, we have to unite. I look today at the Patriot Movement, and I deal with, you know, Gun Owners of America. I deal with all these different organizations, or I've tried to, and they will not step away from their myopic grasp on the one thing that they think's important, because that's what brings them money.
Yeah.
And they're the problem. Folks, I'm telling you, all of these people, the jural assemblies, oh, this is what we got to do. You know, it's one thing if we all communicate and we all agree to go that direction. And when it came down to it in Continental Congress, that's what they started doing. And bottom line, after another almost decade, right? So it was two and a half decades, technically, from 1762 to 1766 or 1776. That was just a decade on almost a quarter, a little over a quarter. So, and then we go to 1787 when they finally have the Constitutional Convention. So we're looking almost 25 years span time of, you know, struggling as a nation or as different sovereign states and trying to create a nation that would function and work. It took them that amount of time. How long have we as states and we as people been basically been beaten and, you know, they're killing us, right? They're killing us with the chemtrails. I mean, how long have we been subjected to all of this type of tyranny? I'm going to say it's got to be more than 25 years now.
Yeah. You know, I have no idea.
Well, the Patriot, the John Birch Society goes all the way back to the 1950s. And I see a lot of other organizations that have been around for a couple of decades easily. Couple, three, four.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the John Birch Society is heading up to almost a century. You know, just a few decades away. So, here's my point. They realized that they needed to bond together on the fundamental principles of and get away from the religious division and decide to basically join and adjoin to the concept of the laws of nature and nature's God, which are the common agreed upon principles, you know, of, I don't want to say, I'll say Christianity in a very generic sense. That being said, because they were able to unite, and instead of creating a theocracy, they did the exact opposite. They created a nation. They created a union where everybody had the choice to choose for themselves. And at that point in time, all of the states were and had chosen their faith and doctrine that they wanted to govern themselves in their state. So they had to make sure that this federal government was going to be unfettered and not be able to, you know, start picking favors or favorites towards, you know, one faith or another, even though there were maybe five states that were the Anglican. I think that was the largest group of states that had, you know, a fixed doctrine, the Anglican Church, the Episcopal Church. And I think one of the reasons why they just had this problem with actually affixing the United States to the Anglican Church is just due to the fact that that was the Church of Britain. They knew that if they actually said, we're going to follow the Anglican Church, and technically, that wasn't Protestant.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't Protestant. And you'll actually find people out there, you know, saying that Protestant was the predominant, but actually it really wasn't. There was nothing really predominant, because when you start looking at the different states, there was enough division to create, you know, no clear majority. No clear majority. So the point is that they felt moved, or they felt, you know, convicted to try to create a system that allowed the states to have it however they wanted to have it. I believe that when they started breaking up the states, what the states should have done, but the nine times out of 10, you never empower beneath you. And I've said this before, that the states were the problems. The original states were the problems. The new states coming in had the and the county's been formed properly, I don't think that the new states coming in would have had all the power, or at least the state legislature would have realized that they were a general government and that they weren't the almighty powerful government. But I think that the one of the problems was is they were looking at how the other states were configured, and they were just being copycats. It's as a matter of fact, we tend to be copycats. I'll give you a good case in point. How many different political parties are there?
Five.
Well, so we know that there's the Democrat and Republican. We know that there's the Libertarian. We know that there's the Constitution Party, but the Constitution Party is just, you know, a blip, right? There's the Independent American Party, another little blip. We look at, on the other side, what is it, the Green Party, the Communist Party? I mean, there's probably, I'm going to say, you probably wouldn't be wrong of over 20 parties.
Really? Wow. Okay.
Okay, so out of all of the parties, their platforms may be starkly different, but the way they function is ironically identical. In other words, when they get a person from the independent or an independent person from the Libertarian or Constitution Party, what have you, that actually can get into office, not one of these parties has a mechanism of holding that person in office accountable to their oath. The Constitution Party definitely does not want to do that. On the left side, they, by design, want these public servants to, one, be corrupted so that they can be moved in the direction they need to be moved. But why, on the conservative side, is there no accountability for the Republicans, Libertarians, Constitution Party, IAPs, and so forth in the party bylaws? And why is it that they do not demand that if a person bearing their party name is in office, why is it that they do not demand the removal of that person, or at least the exile from the office, so that the next time they run, they can't use the Republican name? So every party has a laissez-faire paradigm where they don't care about what that person does in office, or at least they have no accountability to that person. It got so bad in Arizona that with John McCain being literally not just a rhino, but a flaming liberal Democrat, that Arizona basically had to censure him, and they tried to remove him, but they realized that they had no teeth in the law to be able to do so.
Yeah, that's true.
And they didn't have it in their bylaws or anything else. And I think, you know, when you have a problem like that, you try to, you know, make those changes, but then ultimately it comes down to the law where these people, these politicians, have protected themselves so that the party can't hold them accountable. Even today, if the party wanted to hold them accountable, they couldn't. And there's no way, other than in Wyoming, where Frank Ethorn has really chosen to try to hold these people accountable. And he's ran into nothing but roadblocks with the law and the legislature. We're not going to allow you to hold us accountable. You can't do that. You have to take us into court each time. You cannot just remove and excommunicate us from your party. And that is just antithetical to any brand or any type of organizational control. Organizations should have control over those who represent them.
Absolutely.
Every company in the world, and as a matter of fact, I bring this case up all the time, that there was a young man, or not a young man, there was a nurse, he was a male nurse, and I forget whether it was Tennessee, Kentucky, or even deeper in the South, it doesn't matter. This was around the COVID time. This was like in 2021, where this man went into this donut shop, and I don't know if he was covering his mouth or whatever. Maybe it was before that. It may have not even had to do with COVID. But he was white, and the employees were basically giving him a hard time because they were of a different color and a different race. And so there was obviously, you know, some animosity. And this guy, they were basically goading this guy. They were doing outlandish things to see if this guy would respond. And I think there was probably some history behind this, if you really look. And I wouldn't be surprised. But bottom line, this guy liked going to this donut shop to get some donuts, either after work, before work, or what have you. And when these two characters at the employees at that restaurant were never held accountable for what they did, but they were able to goat this guy into finally responding with racial epithets. And so as he let them let them fly, and before he even went to work the next day, because I think this was on his way home, I think he was a night nurse, and before he even went to work the next day, that video that they captured had got viral enough that the hospital had fired him. Mm-hmm. And they made an official statement that this person does not represent this business, this hospital, and our policies and how we feel. And therefore, we're firing that person right now on the spot. Didn't even know. I mean, anyway. So if a business can do that, then how is it that the parties can't, especially when parties are ideologically based, right?
I mean, at the county level, you can do that with the executive team, but not the precinct committee people, because they're voted in.
But it doesn't matter. So if everybody takes an oath, and this is the real secret, folks, if we started demanding every person in politics, if you're in politics, you got to take an oath to support the Constitution, because everybody, by the expectations and by the obligations of every U.S. citizen, we're all required to support and defend the Constitution. So it doesn't mean that only when you're called up as the militia, but in every aspect of your life, you should be doing things that would support and defend that Constitution. Ergo, if you choose not to, and you choose to actually go against the Constitution as a PCO, or whether you're a representative or a judge or even an officer of the court, because if you've taken an oath to support and defend the Constitution as a U.S. citizen, then you should be removed from functioning within our governing apparatus. And officers of the court technically are functioning within the government apparatus, because the legal system that has been created is created to support the law. Right? I mean, that makes mm-hmm. sense. I mean, it's the whole point of actualizing and enforcing the law. So anyway, I know I went down this long path, so forgive me. It all started with Massachusetts. But bottom line, Massachusetts was a very advanced state with education and so forth. So they felt that they had this real advantage. And that's one of the reasons why during the ratification debates, they were the only state that I saw that said, we can do this without them. We don't need the rest of the union. We can exist without them. However, they were the ones that we actually went to save their butts, right? Because mm-hmm. they were the rebel rousers, and they got the ire of England on them, and so we had to go and bail them out. It's kind of like France, right? How many times have we had to bail France out of a world war? Twice. So anyway, so that's some backstory on Massachusetts, and one of the reasons why, you know, the states were literally the bad guys. At least those states that felt they had the big enough britches to challenge, you know, this general authority.
Right.
The little states needed that general authority to protect them. But these bigger states said, we can ignore this because, you know, we've got enough power. We've got our own little army here. We can do what we want. So the point is that from the very beginning, the states have been the problem. And so it had continued under the constitutional era with slavery and so forth, that the states were the problem. This ended This literally ended constitutionally with the 14th Amendment. Right, wrong, or indifferent, the 14th Amendment basically inflicted the Constitution and the rights of U.S. citizens to be protected by the states, that no state could make or enforce any law that would abridge those privileges and immunities, because the states were behaving so badly that they, and the states actually amended the Constitution to do that. Now, didn't mean that down the road there are a few states that tried to undo that amendment, and that 14th Amendment has been sullied for years and years and years by people with, I'll just say, nefarious designs in trying to basically get rid of this protection for we the people. As we've read the 14th Amendment, it was literally the teeth that was necessary to the Constitution. Section 3 all by itself was that critical. But Section 1 in protecting we the people from our own state government was absolutely critical. And we just saw with the pandemic how states actually behaved badly again.
Yep.
And people are still sullying the 14th Amendment. And I'm going, I don't get it. It makes no sense other than the fact that these people have just really bad paradigms and bad information, that they look at this thing and they fail to truly examine the 14th Amendment. That all being said, we just ended, and we're right now still in Article 6, that no state shall lay any imposts or duties which may interfere with any stipulations and treaties entered into by the United States and Congress assembled. And we learned through the ratification debates that this was being severely violated. It was in North Carolina, it was in Virginia, and I believe it was even in Massachusetts. And the only reason it wasn't in Pennsylvania is because the way they did the debates, but I'm pretty sure that it was there. But we left off with that paragraph, so go ahead and read the next one.
Okay, no vessel of war shall be kept up in time of peace by any state, except such number only as shall be deemed necessary by the United States and Congress assembled for the defense of such state or its trade, nor shall anybody of forces be kept up by any state in time of peace, except such number only as in the judgment of the United States and Congress assembled, shall be deemed requisite to garrison the forts necessary for the defense of such state. But every state shall always keep up a well-regulated and disciplined militia, sufficiently armed and accoutred, and shall provide and constantly have ready for use in public stores a due number of file pieces and tents and a proper quantity of arms, ammunition, and camp equipage.
Okay, so far, they didn't think that they needed a navy, that they only thought they needed to defend themselves on the soil. When really, how was a foreign nation of Europe going to entangle and get involved with these states, these 13 states? Well, they'd have to get on a ship, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we had Canada to the north, and we had Mexico to the south. So they could amass a lot of forces and try to attack us that way. But when you look at Georgia, and when you look at the New England states, and you look at the population, there weren't a lot of people up there until you got to Massachusetts. And Massachusetts was this very small, very dense population state. Georgia itself was another dense population state. Did you know that?
Did not.
Okay, so Georgia, the plots of land, because it was based on indentured servitude, and so because we're going into a break and because Tammy cannot hear me, I will repeat this when we come back, because understanding the density of population would kind of help you understand, you know, the strategically looking at how we would defend ourselves as a new confederation. And it just amazes me that they had no navy. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so we were talking about the strategic defense of this new confederation. And as they, you know, were in a hurry to put this together, they were really more focused on the militia and the ground forces. Obviously, you can see that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They had no idea. They had no desire whatsoever. They didn't mention the Navy at all, did they?
No.
No vessel of war shall be kept in time of peace by any state. No Navy. Huh. So how was it that when you really look at these states, and we were talking about density, so Massachusetts was a very dense state. There was like a 500,000 people up there in that little state. There were about 100,000 in Georgia. However, the land plots that were given to the indentured servants as they were being released of good behavior by coming here from the, I'll call it, it was a penal colony because these were prisoners. These were, I believe, like white crawler or, you know, people that didn't do violent crime, but they were just petty crime, what have you, that were willing to come to America to work off and actually have some land given to them. They were given 10 acres of land. The average indentured servant coming over in the very beginning was about 100 acres of land.
Mm-hmm.
So by having 10-acre plots in Georgia, Britain did this strategically to create a denser population. So if the Spaniards from Florida decided to march north to attack the other colonies, and they would be the first one to find out. And Georgia would have enough density to be able to, you know, respond in kind or at least kind of hold them off while the word was being given to Carolinas and so forth, that, you know, they would sound the alarm and everybody would prepare that Spain was going to march upon them. Canada was the same thing. It happened to be an area that was kind of quasi-controlled by France and Britain until a point where Britain basically took over. But the point is this, that the real projection of force to be able to effectively attack America had to come by sea. Because to hold and to basically execute a ground campaign across this mass of these colonies or these new independent states would take more than a year's time. They didn't have highways. So how did Britain constantly attack us? They basically came ashore. They basically got a beachhead or a forest head, or, you know, they created these encampments and they basically fought us from New York and where they had these toeholds. And they would prosecute campaigns that way. And they would basically bring their naval ships along up ports. And as a matter of fact, the way they came at us in the War of 1812, technically it was 1812 was a worldwide war. The whole, a good part of the world was being lit up because France was going through Europe and because England decided to come through America. But it wasn't united forces, you know, taking on one enemy or what have you. But nevertheless, the point is this, is that when the 1812 war was being prosecuted, the British Navy came up the Potomac, and they basically landed in D.C. and attacked us directly in D.C. They knew that if they tried somewhere else, it would take a long time to prosecute that war. And the amount of people and the amount of you know, logistics and everything else to prosecute that kind of war would have been a Herculean effort by Britain. And Britain was not going to invest that much capital. I think what they did was they wanted to take us by surprise to see if they could get us to capitulate, because they took down our head. And actually, because we had 13 sovereign states and, you know, of the people in D.C. came from those states, it didn't mean that they basically took away our ability to fight them. And so Jackson was the one that fundamentally ended the war with an overwhelming, or yeah, ended the war with a big bang, because he kicked their butts. And so the Treaty of Ghent was signed, and this is where we were finally recognized, and Britain had to honor the treaty, or they would have had to have dealt with this more. But didn't mean Britain went away. They just stopped harassing us. Okay, so when we look at what they're building here as their national defense and, you know, how this is going to be maintained, they're not talking about a navy at all, even though the war would come by sea. There's no way in heck it would even make sense that they would go up the Mississippi and try to marshal forces, because they would, the size of the army they would have to have and the logistics that they would need to support a campaign going through the Midwest eastward into D.C., New York, and so forth would have just been, you know, it would have taken too much. There's just no way. There's just no way. We would have noticed the amassing and all of that, and they couldn't have. The only way they could actually attack us is by hitting us, you know, on our ports and, you know, on the coastline, period, and taking us by surprise. This other way of just being ready with the militia, I know. But see, the Articles of Confederation were being written at the time where we were already in war. So those people that were actually engaged the most weren't sailors. They were land forces. In other words, that's why you didn't see this. I think this is one of the reasons why. It's the same thing with why did Washington not build up the Navy? Because he was a land guy. He was an infantryman. He wanted the land forces to be the primary defense, even though the Constitution clearly said that the United States shall, you know, create and maintain a Navy. Anywho, so no state shall engage in any war without the consent of the United States. Go ahead.
No state shall engage in any war without the consent of the United States and Congress assembled, unless such state be actually invaded by enemies, or shall have received certain advice of a resolution being formed by some nation of Indians to invade such state, and the danger is so imminent as not to admit of a delay till the United States in Congress assembled can be consulted, nor shall any state grant commissions to any ships or vessels of war, nor letters of marque or reprisal, except it be after declaration of war by the United States and Congress assembled, and then only against the kingdom or state and the subject thereof, against which war has been so declared and under such regulations as shall be established by the United States and Congress assembled, unless such state be infested by pirates, in which case vessels of war may be fitted out for that occasion and kept so long as the danger shall continue or until the United States and Congress assembled shall determine otherwise.
In other words, they weren't going to have a navy unless you really forced their hand to have one.
Yeah.
Okay. So this was their strategic plan of how they were to defend themselves. Article 7. Go ahead.
When land forces are raised by any state for the common defense, all officers of or under the rank of colonel shall be appointed by the legislature of each state respectively. Really? by whom such forces shall be raised, or in such manner as such state shall direct, and all vacancies shall be filled up by the state which first made the appointment.
Okay, so this is interesting because they were granting to the states this power and or authority over the promotion of officers, right?
Yeah, except for that doesn't seem very timely.
Well, so I understand that, but what does the Constitution say? So when we look at the Constitution, the very similar language that they imported into Article 1, Section 8, right, was reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of the training the militia to the discipline prescribed by Congress. In other words, the federal government didn't really have any control over the appointment of officers, except, I would think, at the very top level of the Department of War, where the commander-in-chief would, while federalized, would take those officers and whoever the Secretary of War at the time was, Knox or whomever. But what they did was they would, you know, appoint or promote those people to the office of general, colonel, what have you. But it was very specific in the Articles of Confederation that they could not assume, or the states could not grant a rank above, what was it, lieutenant colonel?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, in other words, reserving colonel and above, colonel and general, for the federal government, or for Congress to basically promote that. Okay. All right. So, go ahead. Did we go ahead and cover the next article?
Okay. All charges of war and all other expenses that shall be incurred for the common defense or general welfare and allowed by the United States and Congress assembled shall be defrayed out of a common treasury, which shall be supplied by the several states in proportion to the value of all land within each state, granted or surveyed for any person, as such land and the buildings and improvements thereon shall be estimated according to such mode as the United States and Congress assembled shall from time to time direct and appoint.
Okay. So go ahead and read the last part of Article 8.
The taxes for paying that proportion shall be laid and levied by the authority and direction of the legislatures of the several states within the time agreed upon by the United States and Congress assembled.
Okay, so the paying for, the taxes for paying that proportion which shall be levied by the authority and direction of the legislature. So, in other words, they're supposed to actually come up with when they're going to pay them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what happens if they don't?
I don't know.
Then they don't get paid. You see, they didn't put any teeth, and they knew that the states weren't going to... I mean, so the Articles of Confederation were being passed around when the states really needed the Union. Does that make sense? Because they were at war. Remember, we started this where the Articles of Confederation really started in 1777. And they weren't actually done until, what was the title again? March 1st, 1781, 2 years into the war. And so, as we kind of look at what they were doing for those first few years in the war, this is a point in time when they realized they really needed to have a more energetic government than the one they created on paper before it was ratified. So you would think that they would have at least by 1781, they would have said, no, we need to have more energy to this. Let's amend it now because we need to protect ourselves. I honestly think that Rhode Island, Delaware, and some of the smaller states didn't see, because they weren't being affected as much. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
They didn't have as much on the line as the bigger states did.
Right.
And so one of the catch-alls that, even though this was a pig, in concept and actual content, because it didn't give them any force. Continental Congress was just useless. So the fact that this got created, and in the process of creating this, the unanimity required, in other words, all states had to buy off on a change. They couldn't make a change without 100% agreeing. So anyway, so it was, this whole concept of the Articles of Confederation was dead before it was born. Anyway.
Yeah.
Article 9.
Article 9, the United States and Congress assembled shall have the sole and exclusive right and power of determining on peace and war, except in the cases mentioned in the 6th article, of sending and receiving ambassadors, entering into treaties and alliances, provided that no treaty of commerce shall be made whereby the legislative power of the respective states shall be restrained from imposing such imposts and duties on foreigners as their own people are subjected to, or from prohibiting the exportation or importation of any species of goods or commodities whatsoever, of establishing rules for deciding in all cases what captures on land or water shall be legal, and in what manner prizes taken by land or naval forces in the service of the United States shall be divided or appropriated, of granting letters of marque and reprisal in times of peace, appointing courts for the trial of piracies and felonies committed on the high seas, and establishing courts for receiving and determining finally appeals in all cases of captures, provided that no member of Congress shall be appointed a judge of any of the said courts.
Okay, so what we've got right here is this concept of protecting the small states and at the expense of the bigger states, because the states that would really pay more and support the war more and so forth would have been the southern states or the bigger states, the states with greater population and the states with greater resources. You got to remember that after the war, the Shay Rebellion and the ability to make money up in the New England states was very difficult. We already know this because the Assumption Act was necessary to supposedly keep the New England states in the Union because they couldn't pay their debt. So the fact that the federal government was going to go ahead and say, okay, we take on your debt and you've been relieved. We've exonerated you of the debt and we've carried that forward. We will take care of that for you. Well, in doing that, the federal government also had to basically create favors to equalize everything out to the states that paid their debt, putting the federal government at a greater obligation than what was really required. And so this all created, it was like this perfect little storm for somebody like Hamilton to exploit and basically put things in motion that were catastrophic, absolutely catastrophic. None of it was legitimate. None of it was constitutional. But still, under the Constitution, Hamilton was able to do some really bad things. Now, when we kind of look at the ties that were supposedly on the states' hands, those ties only were on the smaller states. The smaller states were happy to abide by these things. It was the bigger states that were, you know, and some of the smaller states were gaming it as well, like Rhode Island. So gaming it, in other words, being, well, if everybody else is doing, we're going to do it. But the design of this was really more to protect, to ensure that the smaller states would have their autonomy and sovereignty in equal footing. So they kind of created this advantage, and the large states basically said, you may have created a perceived advantage, but you have no teeth to make it real.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this next line, or this next paragraph, go ahead, this is a long one.
Yeah, this is very long. The United States and Congress assembled shall also be the last resort on appeal and all disputes and differences now subsisting or that hereafter may arise between two or more states concerning boundary, jurisdiction, or any other causes, whatever, which authority shall always be exercised in the manner following.
Mm-hmm. Keep going.
Whenever the legislative or executive authority or lawful agent of any state in controversy with another shall present a petition to Congress stating the matter in question and praying for a hearing, notice thereof shall be given by order of Congress to the legislative or executive authority of the other state in controversy, and a day assigned for the appearance of the parties by their lawful agents, who shall then be directed to appoint, by joint consent, commissioners or judges, to constitute a court for hearing to determine and determining the matter in question. Do you want me to keep going?
Yeah, keep going. Yeah, huh? Yeah.
It's a very long sentence. But if they cannot agree, Congress shall name three persons out of each of the United States. From the list of such persons, each party shall alternately strike out one, the petitioner's beginning, until the number shall be reduced to 13, and from that number not less than 7, no more than 9 names as Congress shall direct, shall in the presence of Congress be drawn out by lot, persons whose names shall be so drawn, or any 5 of them shall be commissioners or judges, to hear and finally determine the controversy, so always as a major part of the judges who shall hear the cause shall agree in the determination. And if either party shall neglect to attend at that day appointed without showing reasons, which Congress shall judge sufficient, or being present shall refuse to strike, the Congress shall proceed to nominate 3 persons out of each state, and the Secretary of Congress shall strike in behalf of such party absent or refusing. And the judgment and sentence of the court to be appointed in the manner before prescribed shall be final and conclusive. And if any of the parties shall refuse to submit to the authority of such court or to appear or defend their claim or cause, the court shall nevertheless proceed to pronounce sentence or judgments which shall in like manner be final and decisive. The judgment or sentence and other proceedings being in either case transmitted to Congress and lodged among the acts of Congress for the security of the parties concerned, provided that every commissioner, before he sits in judgment, shall take an oath to be administered by one of the judges in the Supreme or Superior Court of the state where the cause shall be tried,
mm-hmm.
well and truly to hear and determine the matter in question, according to the best of his judgment, without favor, affection, or hope of reward, provided also that no state shall be deprived of territory for the benefit of the United States.
So what did they just do here? This is how they were going to resolve legal disputes among the states. Right? That's what you basically mm-hmm. just read. So in other words, they did not create a judiciary. They created a process for creating a judiciary when the time demanded it. Why was it that they didn't create a permanent judiciary? Because that would have created another bunch of employees that who had to pay for it?
Right.
The states would have had to pay for it. And so the more they created in government manpower, the more the states would have to pay. And so, again, the states, they concocted this document to actually make a joke more out of these roles that Congress was going to have, but they couldn't really afford to pay a judiciary when the states couldn't even pay for, many of the states couldn't pay for their own representation.
Right.
So, there was obviously some real challenges here. So, this next one is really key because I've highlighted this, because this really defines, you know, I would say the jurisdiction, and that word right there comes in. So go ahead.
Right. All controversies concerning the private right of soil claimed under different grants of 2 or more states, whose jurisdictions, as they may respect such lands in the states which pass such grants are adjusted, the said grants or either of them being at the same time claimed to have originated antecedent to such settlement of jurisdiction shall, on the petition of either party to the Congress of the United States, be finally determined, as near as may be, in the same manner as is before prescribed for deciding disputes respecting territorial jurisdiction between different states.
Okay, so this was strictly just determining where, you know, where, how they were going, and they were going to follow the exact same process of forming a committee and or a commission so that they would go and levy a judgment. Now, just imagine if all of the independent and sovereign states had all of these different disputes, and they did have some. This was so taxing on Continental Congress to be able to, you know, follow this process to get the names required.
Yeah, it would be.
Right. Instead of having a fixed judiciary already set. So in other words, as you look at how they were framing this, it was, I'm just going to use the word, a joke. Mm-hmm. In contrast to the Constitution. Okay. Go ahead with the next paragraph then.
The United States Congress assembled shall also have the sole exclusive right and power of regulating the alloy and value of coin struck by their own authority or by that of their respective states, fixing the standards of weights and measures throughout the United States, regulating the trade and managing all affairs with the Indians, not members of any states, provided that the legislative right of any state within its own limits be not infringed or violated, establishing or regulating post offices from one state to another throughout all the United States, and exacting such postage on the papers passing through the same as may be requisite to defray the expenses of the said office, appointing all officers of the land forces in the service of the United States, accepting regimental officers, appointing all the officers of the naval forces, and commissioning all officers, whatever, in the services of the United States, making rules for the government and regulation of the said land and naval forces and directing their operations.
Okay, so here we have the ability for the states to make their own coins, because obviously, the United States in Congress assembled shall also have the sole and exclusive right and power of regulating the alloy and value of the coin struck by their own authority or by that of the respective states. In the Constitution, the only coins that could be struck and minted were by the federal government. Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution is pretty clear, and let me actually get to that, because this is what it says. No state shall enter into their own treaty, alliance, or confederation, grant letters of marque or marquee, and reprisal, coin money. No state shall coin money. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Oh, we ran out of time. We've got to have Tammy back, because I'm going to ask her a question about Wyoming minting their own coins. So anyway, I'll have to remember for that for next time, because this one really snuck up on us. Anyway, folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.